Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Horse Friends podcast. Today, I have Katrin Vorstadt from Ride Like a Viking with me here in the interview. And Katrin will help us and tell us a little bit about what she has experienced with horses, how her point of view to how she's seeing horses today has been shifting over the years. And I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. We had a little bit of preparation conversation already the days before. And I can tell you it will become an interesting story today. Good morning, Katrin.
Good morning, Selina. So Hi. Nice to be here.
And it's so nice to have somebody else from Norway here, because we don't have so many. Do we have many horse professionals in Norway? Not too many, right?
Oh, there are not so many horses either.
Yeah, exactly. We are a small country.
Small horse country. I was reading something about 160,000 to 200,000 horses.
Wow.
In Norway, and that would mean maybe 100,000 horse owners, I guess.
Approximately, yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, very, and then we very have small breeders. Mm-hmm. Part
very,
of the population.
Small community. Yeah.
And like Mongolia, they were 1.6 million people and have 4 million horses.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
And wow. Iceland also, I think they have more horses than people. There are a couple of countries in the world.
That is impressive. That is really impressive. And this is exactly where I got a little bit interested in your story, because before I contacted you, what I read about you and what I heard from friends, we have a friend that we share, I think, is that you have been on a certain time in your life traveling to Mongolia and doing the amazing, how many kilometers is it, this amazing wild horse race there?
It is 1,000 kilometers on horseback.
1,000?
Yes.
Wow.
That's you hit the wall when doing this race. Everyone who gets to the finish line has hit the wall and climbed over it.
How many days are you riding for these 1,000 kilometers?
You have 10 days. So to reach the finish line. And you, of course, don't ride this on one horse. So the Mongol Derby is set up like the Genghis Khan postal system. So you get a new horse for every 30 to 40 kilometers.
Okay.
So each horse only goes one leg, but you ride the full 1,000K. Yeah.
Okay. So the horses are going from station to station?
Yes.
And then that means you're riding 3 to 4 horses per day?
Yeah. About 3 to 4 horses, yes.
Okay. And how do you prepare for an event like this? I mean, you don't know the horse, so obviously it's not, you know.
Yeah, you can't really ride 1,000 kilometers to prepare for riding 1,000 kilometers. I don't think that's possible. But I did a couple of things. I tried to find out where my strengths were for participating in the race. And I also tried to find my weaknesses so I could work on them. And I think my strength was that I live on a farm and I have many horses. So it's easy for me to ride different horses and to ride a lot. But I think one of my biggest weaknesses was I don't know how to navigate. And you are supposed to navigate this route yourself on horseback.
Wow.
Which isn't that hard once you learn how to operate.
What do you get? Are you having a map then? And I mean, you don't get a Google Maps GPS, I would say, but how do you navigate?
I use the Garmin.
GPS. So this is allowed. Yeah. Okay, so it is allowed to use.
Yeah, GPS. Yeah. And you can use maps if you want to.
Okay.
So you're free to choose. But the Garmin was a very good tool to have there. But they don't really have any maps of Mongolia, actually. So it's at least the time when I was riding, you didn't have like the topography showing in the Garmin maps like you would in other countries, because they haven't been covering
wasn't
this
covered,
country
was simply not
yeah
covered.
Some parts near the Russian border was covered by probably Russians who have been photographing and doing it, but you know, most parts of Mongolia don't, you can't, call with the cell phone, and there's no typography of the landscape in these maps you get.
That sounds interesting.
Yes, it was, and I got lost.
But eventually you have survived.
Wow, but I would have gotten even more lost if I hadn't practiced navigating and also practiced, you know, staying outside and riding on my own. So I think one of the biggest things I did and smartest things I did before the race was to head out on a horse riding adventure on my own and navigate myself and also test all the gear. So you are allowed to bring like 5 kilos of equipment, and that's supposed to be then your sleeping bag and survival stuff. And you need to know where different things are and how the sleeping bag works outside in the cold and, you know, stuff like that. So,
okay.
And I also worked a lot on my balance when riding. So I rode the bareback.
Okay. So how do you come to the idea from your cozy farm in Norway to say, okay, 1,000 miles in Mongolia, this is something I really want to do?
I think it was a combination of boredom and 40-year crisis.
Okay.
I was getting a bit bored by doing the same in stuff in the same way, riding the same horses in the same way. Like I felt like I've gone into kind of a pattern.
Yeah.
That I wanted to get out of. And I also wanted to, you know, test myself, like see how much I can endure. And I also wanted to get in shape. So then what I also did was to go then to a training studio and get in shape. Yes. Because I was thinking like if you live an active life and you go to the barn and stuff, then you will be in shape, which is true. But going to a studio and being pushed towards your maximum pulse and really start sweating, that's a whole different story.
Yeah.
So I guess I was in the shape of my life before entering, because I knew that was really, really important to be in great physical shape. And I would probably not have gotten in that great physical shape unless I had this big event to work towards.
And how is that working? I mean, can you, as a Western person, can you just call someone and say, I want to ride with you, or send an email? Or sounds maybe a bit
stupid, but if
I want to do the race now after this conversation, how do I do it?
Oh, you apply to the Adventurist. So there's this is an organized event.
Ah, okay.
Yes, yes. So they don't mark the route, but they pick out the route. Mm-hmm. And they also pick out Mongolian nomadic families to run the stations and to bring horses.
Okay, so it is a little bit organized, at least.
It's very, very much organized. So all the horses who participate in the race are vetted beforehand. And there are also veterinarian tests along the route. So every time you enter a station, the horse you've been riding on is being scrutinized in a veterinarian check, where they take the heart rate. So the heart rate must not exceed 56 beats per minute within half an hour of entering the station. And in regular endurance, it's 64.
Yeah, okay.
And they also check for wounds and lameness and hydration.
Okay.
So if your horse is wounded, dehydrated, lame, and doesn't reach 56 beats per minute within half an hour, you get kind of a red flag. And after 3 red flags, you are disqualified. So you can only mess up like 3 times. Oh, 2 times. The 3rd time, you're out. You're disqualified. Out. Yeah.
Okay. Tough. Sounds pretty tough. I'm very, very impressed. So then you put everything into your suitcase, and then you went to Mongolia, and then?
Yeah, I didn't really put everything in my suitcase because what I heard was that some of the participants had had troubles with getting their luggage once arriving in Mongolia. And I spent months, you know, making the perfect kit and getting it down to 5 kilos and what to wear. So basically what you wear at the starting line is what you wear at the finish line.
I see. Yeah.
So I dressed myself up as if I was attending the race with my saddlebag and my backpack. And then I had other stuff that I didn't really need in the suitcase.
Okay.
Yeah. So that could be important. The year I attended, one of the attendees, he didn't get his luggage. So he needed then to try to figure out how to get his gear in Mongolia, which wasn't very easy.
And what was your expectation when you were coming to the race? And what was your actual experience there?
So my goal was to reach the finish line in one piece and like not break my neck or become disqualified, or because it's a dangerous race. So stuff has happened. People have broken their necks and stuff.
Okay.
From doing this, because the horses are semi-wild and they might be bucking and bolting and you fall off, right? So that was it wasn't my expectation, but that was my goal, to stay safe and reach the finish line. And I also had a goal of not getting any veterinarian remarks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, ride it within the 10 days and the time available. Yeah.
Okay. So there's two things when you're telling it like this, two things that I'm hanging on a little bit. It sounds like you had no expectation at all, more than surviving. I would be a bit scared that I'm reaching my physical limits, like, you know, hitting the wall very regularly when I'm doing that. And the second thing where my ear is hanging on is it's semi-wild horses. You know, I'm coming from the very other end. I'm doing academic art of riding, where it's all about preparation and laying the ground and building up this teaching structure with horses and so on and so on. So how do you do that with a semi-wild horse?
The Mongolian horses are kept like wild and free in herds, and there are no fences there.
Okay.
So they have a very, very different horse culture than what we have. So it's not like the horses had never been ridden before. They were just kept and handled in a totally different way than how we would keep and handle our horses. So the horses need to keep their wild spirit to be able to survive without human interference. So they need to be able to run from predators, find their own food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to do that, they can't be too tame and too depending on humans.
Mm-hmm.
So like in Norway, if I want to go riding, I go out with a halter and lead rope and I fetch my horse and bring it into the stable. In Mongolia, when they want to go riding, it's a whole teamwork of catching horses with these lassos and you know, bringing them to the line and tying them up and then getting the gear on and ride. Okay. So they kind of ride with how the horse is. In a way, so if the horse is bucking, you know, then the horse is bucking. If the horse is bolting, it's bolting. If the horse doesn't have any forward, then the horse doesn't have any forward.
Doesn't have any forward. Okay.
Yeah. The horse is like he or she is.
Okay.
So you are kind of borrowing it, but you're not altering them. And the Mongolians, they were very, very great at, you know, riding in this way. So they would... Since they are small, they are riding and they are kind of born on horseback. So they have this amazing balance and skills from, you know, just going with the horse.
Wow.
So it looks very, very easy when these kids are riding. They are, you know, bareback flying over the, galloping over the step. It looks like freedom. When we tried to do the same thing, we were quickly bucked off because we come in with a different mindset of control. And these horses will sense that immediately. And they will feel it as a threat to their survival. because they don't want a controlling rider on their back, because it means that they can't feed themselves as good, because there are many holes in the ground there from these rodents who are living there. And you can also have predators coming in, and they need to be free to flee. So that was maybe the biggest thing I learned. And before I went to Mongolia, I had this idea of training the horses there and maybe teaching the nomads a little bit about feel and you know, stuff like that.
And how to ride.
Yes. And it was the totally opposite way around. Like, I learned a lot from especially the beginning and how the horses were reacting to me and my mindset.
And then you survived for 10 days.
Yes, I made it to the finish line, and I didn't get any veterinary marks during the 1,000 kilometers. So they were all clear on the vet checks. Yeah. And I also didn't fall off during the race.
Wow. Congratulations. That's really impressive. How long is that? When did you take the race? How many years is it now?
It was in 2015. So it's 7 years ago.
How has that experience changed your perspective on horses?
It has taught me very much about myself and my own need of control. And it has also taught me how sensitive horses really are, and they will feel our intentions. So from the way you use your seat to your hands to everything. And that was the big clue to being able to ride the Mongol Derby without being bucked off and without getting any wet remarks. I think it was from the initial training. So we had 3 days out on the step, learning about these horses and trying out the gear and such. And I also actually learned a little bit from the Mongolians there. The nomads were then, they don't speak English, but you can kind of hear from their grunts if you are on the right path or not.
You can hear from the grunts. That's great.
Yeah. Like, that was not good. So in the beginning, I kind of mounted the horse and I wanted to kind of test if it was possible to steer them and such. And then the Hmong nomads were grunting like, don't do that, you know, don't fiddle with the reins. So I was just going to like, does the horse knows what the left rein is and right rein? And they were like, just go. Like, and it really worked, because if you didn't kind of allow them to just go, they would feel trapped, right? And the horse would also wonder what's the point in these circles? Like, aren't we supposed to do something useful, like get to the next place or herd sheep or whatever? So it was like just doing dressage exercises, or I was more like into the bend to stop and stuff. It was like an insult to the horse and to the nomads in a way. And it also made the horses feel trapped and like, they had a boss rider who wanted to decide everything. Mm-hmm. While they, of course, were the ones who knew how to
deal with
it. Navigate and be in Mongolia. You know, I didn't know that, but the horse knew it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Smart. Trust your pony. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Trust your pony.
So you were a dressage rider before, or?
Yeah, probably more into dressage stuff. Yeah, or Icelandic horse rider. But Icelandic horse riding has been very, very much influenced by dressage.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you came home and met again your horses, what did they say?
Yeah, they felt very big, actually, although I have Icelandic horses.
Okay.
When I mounted one of my own horses, I felt like I had lots of neck in front of me. Because the Mongolian horses are related to the Icelandic horses. But the breeding has gone in very, very different directions. So in Mongolia, the best horse is the horse who is able to run the longest mm-hmm. and have the most endurance. Mm-hmm. The fastest horse is the best mm-hmm. horse. Mm-hmm. So they are not breeding on temperament or looks. They are just breeding on this one feature.
Okay.
So most of the horses had very, very low withers and very short necks and very, very big butts. And they would also have like karpelend, it's called in Norwegian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's something we don't see in Icelandic horses anymore, because if you show up with a horse with a carpelen, then you get really bad points, right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, no, for the exterior.
I'm not so good with, yeah, I see. Mm.
So the Icelandic horse has kind of high withers and big, beautiful necks, and it's kind of more proportionate. And they definitely don't have this carpelen. That's considered bad. But what I think is that this carpelen makes it very easy for the horse to get the hind legs underneath them when cantering. So these horses in Mongolia, they are amazing. Like, we had world-class endurance riders doing the race, and they could not believe what they experienced. Like, this is physically impossible for a horse to gallop 30 kilometers and then reach the station and have 56 in heart rate. That's not how you're supposed to ride endurance, right? With a bolting horse.
Okay. No. Not but so these much horses Western standards, yeah.
Did this. And I think it's from the breeding and the exterior. So the horses don't really need to use any effort on getting their hind legs underneath mm-hmm. when cantering. They just push away.
Push away, yeah. Just
and
like,
since
you know,
they
swimming.
Have this, yeah. Since they are not so beautiful and have this carpelen and big butts, this is something that happens kind of automatically. But with the horses we have bred in the Western world, the horse needs to use effort to get the hind legs underneath.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and then maybe also effort to push forwards.
Yeah, makes totally sense to me. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, we so also the horses
selecting on different, I mean, we want different features in our Western world, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. we want a good temperament and a beautiful horse.
Mm-hmm.
They want a fast horse who gets you to the next gear without becoming tired.
But, you know, I also think it's the living conditions that definitely help with the training or with the fastness. I had, you are Norwegian, you know what I mean, but I have my horses in the Utmark. And they are never as good in their fitness level as when they are in the Utmark and needing to search their own food and running up and down the mountain and stuff like that. The PF is never as good as during these summer months. It's amazing. You can't train that in. It's just what nature is giving. It's just, wow.
Yes. And I see that too, because we also have our horses outside and we have summer pastures also mm-hmm. for guests who come with their horse mm-hmm. And keep it here for the summer and then bring it back home.
Yeah.
And all these horses who are coming, they have really amazing back muscle when they are leaving.
When they're going home again.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Also, when I took them in October again, they all had this super round and stable, but it was really impressive. And I thought we have big fields in here, but then the Utmark was doing again a little extra, let's say yes. like this, a little extra.
Mm-hmm.
It was really cool. So, but let's go back to your story. Your business is called Ride Like a Viking.
Yes.
And that is, I would say, heavily influenced from that experience in Mongolia.
Yeah, it's a almost like a coincidence, because during the launch party of the race, it's a very fun race to do because they have set this up to be really an amazing experience as well. So out there on the step, there's a launch party like the day before the race.
Okay.
And we are giving vodka and stuff to cheer and everyone is going to hold a little speech there.
Okay.
And I kind of ended my speech with like, my motto is do it like a Viking. And everyone was like, yeah, the Viking. And then it became like, yeah, I was kind of the Viking and riding like a Viking. And I thought, yeah, why not call my business this? And I also then started to look into how the Vikings were actually training their horses and riding. And it's not the brutal stuff that we would assume a Viking would do. They would really, really cherish their horses because there were so few horses. And they, if you look at the art from the time or descriptions, you see everyone is riding on a loose rein with a mm-hmm. self-controlling horse. And I think we maybe need to go as much as 1,000 years back in time to find like true riding that is, that has a purpose, so that these horses, they need to be self-controlling and collected at the same time to be able to go to wars, and you can ride them with one shield and one spear and, you know, go to battle. You can't do that by controlling and micromanaging a horse. You won't get that result.
That will become difficult, at least. You yes. And you have a horse that is running away the moment the enemy comes and says, okay.
Yes, yes. And I think that's the same with the academic riding. Like, you have found these routes that go before riding to the bit became very popular.
Yeah, I would even say, you know, we have a different, I hope we don't go to war anymore with our horses. I really hope we never need to do that anymore. But I think what we are interested in is this melting together, these moments that you are getting addicted of. And then it's not so much anymore about the exercise that you are doing, but just about this togetherness, where you feel that with your thoughts, you're steering your horse, and how to get into these moments and finding a structure around how to teach that or how to train that both to a horse and, of course, in my job or in our job, also to a human. That's the really interesting point. But of course, we are more nowadays we are more playing in a sandbox, right? While the Mongolians have something that you're actually, they go out and test also what we are just theoretically thinking about. And that, I think, is very, very, very interesting, especially your point of the self-controlling or emotional self-controlling horse, I think, is very important.
Yeah. You need to kind of find that the speed that the horse has from self, in a way. And if it's slower, that's not good. And if the horse is rushing, that's also not good.
Also not good.
And it's not the rider's job to keep that speed. It's the horse's job. And if we allow them to do this from self, they become very grateful.
How can you teach that to a Western student?
Yeah.
You know, how can you, when you have experienced that culture and this very special, you said they are growing up on horseback. And I see this here with my Norwegian family. They are growing up on skis. I will never reach that level when I am trying to learn skiing now. So how can we, what can we learn from them? What are you teaching to us as a Western European people? How can we benefit from that now?
Yeah, so it's a bit two-sided. So I learned like the most from the horses in Mongolia. So they were giving me feedback on my need of control. And the way to stay safe was to let go. But I haven't really been very inspired by the way Mongolians ride or kind of treat their horses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's tough love. Like, my ideal is not to have my horses so wild I need to fetch them with a lasso. and kind of manhandle them to get the saddle on.
Yeah, no, so. But I think this what you are saying there, this feeling of needing to control things, is very deep down in our culture.
Yes, and our nature.
In our heart, yeah, exactly. Yeah. We want to be in control. It's very difficult for us to let go. It nearly sounds a bit Buddhistic, you know, the idea of letting go, giving the horse back the control. And I would say this is our ideal, but also if I think about my own life as a rider and also as a teacher, the most difficult thing to pass on to a student. So how do you manage to bring that across? Or what are you experiencing when you're working with your students there?
Yeah, I have this exercise called the connection exercise.
Aha.
So it starts on the ground with the connection exercise. Mm-hmm. It's basically communication exercise between the horse and rider, where the main job of the rider or the trainer is to kind of let go and not control the horse with the hands, mm-hmm. and start communicating with our body language and our feet and our energy. So I think it maybe begins a little bit with the rope handling. Yes. And the way we lead the horse. And the horse will notice the difference immediately if we lead them differently and do the leading with connection and not from a point of control. And when they experience this, they will feel as if they are together with another horse or still in the herd. And their bodies will take a different shape than what usually happens when a horse is brought from the herd to humans. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it starts there. It starts with working on ourselves. Actually, this exercise gives amazing results in terms of solving behavior problems with horses that I didn't even expect it to do. Like, I'm amazed myself when I get the feedback from people mm-hmm. who have done it. Mm-hmm. They might have had a horse for several years who has been very difficult to handle and very hard to pick up the horse's feet. Like, it's always been a struggle, and they needed to drag the horse down to, you know, get the hoops done.
Yeah.
And they've done the connection exercise for three sessions, and they can just pick up all 4 feet at liberty.
Wow.
Because the horse will immediately notice when we operate from a place of control or we operate from a place of presence and communication. Because that's what horses do when they are together. They are communicating, and they are not controlling each other, and they are presence. They take turns at taking the guard for each other, which makes them feel safe. So that's why we see like a couple of horses standing while the others are lying down. These horses are taking the guard, and this exercise makes us the one taking the guard. So it solves also stuff like separation anxiety. Without pressure or force or treats or control, just from actually noticing what the horse is telling us with their body language and facilitating a relaxation from a distance when the horse is a little bit away from us. So the connection with horses doesn't happen in their space. It happens at a distance. And we can bring that connection then into their space later on. So I'm not doing any tying up or brushing or picking up hooves or anything before I've done the connection exercise.
Are you taking the connection exercise then when you are out with them on the field, or are you taking them into a riding arena, or how are you doing that?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because you somehow have to arrive there.
Bring them, like do it in a paddock. But with horses who have like severe separation anxiety, you can start out in the herd and in the field. So then it might maybe probably be beneficial to start where the horse is the most comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to share with the audience, how are you starting this exercise then? Are you getting into a special mindset?
That's your starting key? Usually by just observing what the horse is doing and take it as valuable information. So you can't really do the connection exercise with aggressive horses who has learned to, you know, become aggressive, defensive when around humans. So then I can do the connection exercise with a fence around me.
Okay, yeah. So basically,
or I start
to stay
with
safe.
Moving the horse with a flag.
Okay.
Asking them to go out of my space. But the majority of horses, you know, I just see what the horse does. Like, what is this horse's behavior when around humans? Is it standoffish? Is it pushy? Most horses disassociate mm-hmm. when around humans and start looking at the environment mm-hmm. to stay safe, because they're like, I'm with someone who isn't present. So I better watch out and take the guard if something should happen, because I don't feel safe. And they will often maybe call out to other horses, like, oh, where's my herd? Like, this is very tiring to be the one on the lookout here, because if we as humans don't recognize their body language, how on earth are we going to spot a wolf in the bushes?
Yeah. Or a deer. I mean, we are in Norway. Yeah. We have a few of them, right? Yeah.
So they often experience us as blind. And we are blind because we are inside our own agenda. By either wanting to teach the horse something or brushing the horse or doing something. While horses, they are hanging out together all the time.
So what you're saying is that presence is the key.
Yes. And taking this as valuable information that what the horse is telling, not as a personal insult. That's also important, because we don't become a leader if we start crying because our horse is doing this or that, or become like personally offended by what they might tell us.
So you are giving them, basically, you are allowing the horse to express their own personality, and you are teaching me as a person to stay present within our own space.
And of course, we also influence the horse a little bit with the way we lead. Like, you give the freedom of choice during the leading, like it's a long lead rope, but I definitely want the horse to do kind of outside turns and not cut to the inside of me.
I would expect that this is a very profound change in relationship.
Yes, it changes both the horse and the human without needing to use force or have very high volumed cues. So earlier, I would definitely start the training with doing stuff like the hooking on or the join up. Monty Roberts method there.
Yeah.
And then you are starting by asking the horse to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But with this exercise, the start is mainly to just see what is this horse's emotional home when with humans. Is it standoffish? Is it pushy? Is it distracted? And then try to facilitate so that we can get another type of togetherness with the horse.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But your goal is then eventually also to go to riding?
Yes. So this connection exercise makes it really, really easy to do then liberty training with body language and without treats. So it will make horses kind of follow us from self. So it makes liberty leading very easy. And again, earlier, I would use the hooking on or the join up as a way to get the horse to follow me at liberty. And that's very much pressure and release, right?
Yes.
So you put pressure on the wrong thing and you release on the right thing. But this is more about the communication and making the horse feel safe and becoming their trusted leader and friend. And then they will follow their friends, right?
Yeah.
From self.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So it gives a very good basis for then liberty training and communication through body language. And once that's good and the horse has found its regular speed and forward from self in a way, that's more when I start influencing them by teaching the riding signals of feel.
Yeah, I see.
Feel this pattern of movement of them finding softness by crossing over behind and becoming soft in their body.
Okay.
So that pattern of movement is very much what's happening in these outside turns and when we're stopping the horse. So we're not making the horse stop, but they find their own stop by crossing over behind. And this pattern of movement is something we then carry with us into the riding.
Yeah, so there again, you find a similarity. What we are doing in academic out of riding, at least we start on the ground and then try to transport it on the back and so on and so on. And that the cycles are closing. But I would expect that from your history, you will also try to transport the feeling of freedom into the riding.
Yes, and I mainly use choices as a way of getting mm-hmm. there. Because if you want to ride at liberty and you haven't given any choices, you need to have a horse who is very obedient to your riding signals mm-hmm. so that you can control the horse mm-hmm. without reins. But if you give choices and make your ID the horse's ID, it becomes very, very easy to ride liberty. You don't need to have a horse who is very obedient to your signals because the horse wants to do the same as you want to do.
Nice.
So, but be careful with this choices thing. It's not so much about making the wrong thing hard as it is about making the right thing easy. So I heard about these choices and this method from Warwick Schiller.
Okay.
Yeah, he does that a lot, especially with like barn sour horses who don't want to leave the barn. You like work them by the barn and you release them on the trail, right? So you kind of put their world view a bit upside down. So they want to go on trails, but they're not so keen on being on by the barn anymore.
I understand. I'm not deep in now that, you know, I'm doing academic out of riding since I'm 16. At least I hadn't gray hair then. So this whole perspective of horsemanship, I have heard about these principles of doing it like this and moving the feet first and stuff. But this is for me like a foreign word. And I also think that Warwick has developed a little the recent years. I don't think he would do that nowadays anymore.
Oh, that must very well be. But yeah. That's how I first learned about these choices was from that the horsemanship world.
Yeah, from the horsemanship world. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how I did it to begin with as well. Like if the horse wanted to go to the gate, I would trot circles by the gate.
Yeah.
And then release on the track. So they will. The horse wants to do the same as we want to do because we're not preventing them from doing the wrong thing. We go with them when doing the wrong thing and make it a little more work than mm-hmm. doing the right thing. Yeah, it's the quote, like, first you go with the horse, then the horse goes with you, then you go together. So that's my path to liberty.
Yes.
But what I found is that we don't necessarily need to make the wrong thing hard. We can make the wrong thing more like valuable exercise for tuning up our riding signals to feel. So now I'm doing this much with a lot less contrast and energy, you might say. Like I'm not like, oh, we're by the gate. Now I need to work. I'm more like, oh, we're by the gate. Maybe I can check to see if my horse can respond to feel in the rain. Maybe I'll check to see if I reach the hind legs with my leg aid and we can do a soft little bend. And when the horse has responded to my light riding signals, that's when I release. And the horses become much less upset by it. And you get really, really good riding signals from doing
and really soft ones, I would expect.
Yeah. And slow. This is slow work.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be so fast and so much because if we then can get the walk good, and this works well at the walk, it's so much easier to carry that with us into the trot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, There I'm feeling more at home. This is This is more closer to what I am working with and say, okay, we need to explain that, calm and easy. And when we can share the same cues and share the connect, it's about the connection, right? And
yes, it is.
We want an emotional complete horse. So it's about the connection and not overriding something or passing the thresholds, but just developing together.
Yes, because they feel our mindset. So if our mindset is like, now I want to get rid of magnets, make my ID the horse's ID, they will kind of feel it. Like, why is my rider so upset now, making me work? Versus like, can you respond? Sometimes it's enough to just get an ear. Like, you get their ear, it's like getting their eyes on the ground and their body will soften and they can kind of do more from self. Yeah.
Let it go. That's a core message. I think that is a core message. Katrin, during the summit, you will give a talk about how free is liberty.
Yes.
I think because when we were discussing a bit, we were also agreeing on that liberty is not always completely free. And I'm very much, I don't want to actually tell too much about that. I'm really looking forward to listen to your lecture. But I think we have learned a lot about your ideals and about your biography. I'm really grateful for that talk this morning. And if people are getting curious, where can they find you? You have a great online program that I can recommend. That's worth checking. You have a great newsletter where people can sign in. So where do we find you?
I would maybe start with the blog. I try to post the blog at least once per month. Mm-hmm. And it's usually a little video giving some helpful tips, I hope. And you can find the blog on ridelikeaviking.com/blog.
Super. We will also put that into the show notes so that people can just click and link and check you out. And then I hope a lot of people will do that. And if they want to develop further with you, they can sign into your online program.
We are today, we also have different free trainings.
Oh, yeah.
So
there.
Yes, we have free trainings that you can sign up for. And you will usually find them at the bottom of the blog, the free training of the season. So in the summer, I often have the gracing exercise as a free training.
Cool.
And at the moment, we have the connection exercise as a free training. But these free trainings aren't open all year, but they have a kind of a time limit. Yes. So you can try out the exercises for free.
And if the connection exercise is what you're always starting with, then this is the perfect moment to get started.
Yes, it is. That's the best start. And don't skip it.
Don't skip it. Go there and try.
The connection we then build on the ground, we carry with us into the riding, just like you are doing in the academic riding.
Yes.
And we can't skip that.
No, we can't skip that. And many people are thinking that an academic out of riding, always when I'm getting new students, they are coming and then they want to show me how beautiful the shoulder in is and, you know, what nice bending and stalling they can do. But most often, I will ask them to just stand with the horse without any shaping, without anything, and just see if the horse can actually be relaxed around them. And very often, this is the point where we have to start. They can't, because the ponies can't, they can't relax. They are nibbling, they can't stop their feet, they're tensed or they are dissociating, like you are saying. So I think this is a little weak spot in the academic art of riding. We don't talk enough often about what we are doing before we are going to the riding arena.
Yeah, we start on the exercises. Yes. Mm-mm.
No. I'm starting with sitting long hours outside on the field and just being there and waiting for my pony to come and say hello.
Yes, that's how you become the herd when away from the herd.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is what we then carry with us into the riding. And it's magical. So nice. You have probably your own version of the connection exercise already going. I can hear that.
Yeah, I would say it's a very private version of that. It's not so easy to, you know, and also when we have the horses in the Utmark here, then I'm walking my dogs outside and just passing by and sleeping a little with the horses when they are sleeping and stuff. But that's, of course, more difficult to transport into other people's lives, right?
So yes,
you are better in having a structure in that. I'm just doing it because I like it. And
I think you are really, really into something there, and which I've thought of is like, okay, if you are keeping your horse in a little small stall and it's outside in a small square paddock with tons of rugs on, I don't know if this will work because the living conditions of the horse will be so far from how horses are supposed to live. Like you are doing, I think you kind of get it from the way you have set up your whole life with your horses.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a shitload of work. But now when we are getting older, we are, of course, allowed to profit from all the work that we have done before, right? Yeah. 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 So I really like that. For me, it's super important that I can keep them as close as possible to nature without needing a lasso to catch them.
I agree on that. We are not Mongolians.
No, I'm not a brave rider. I'm a good rider, but I'm not a brave rider. So I really like it when two bodies are connecting and we are sharing the same idea and things are getting very unspectacular.
Yeah. the slow way is the fast way in the end. And I think we can kind of choose a little bit there. We can start with the excellence and then try and work backwards from there.
Yeah.
Or we can start with the some more boring stuff and work our way towards excellence.
And I also think that when we are getting older now, or when we are getting more experience also as a horse person, that the boring stuff is the really exciting stuff. That's at least what I feel.
Yes, I learn so much every time I do the connection exercise about that particular horse that I don't want to miss. It's so exciting once we start reading them.
Yes.
You know, then it's so much things happening.
It's just different.
Yes, it's different.
It's just different. Now I'm getting goosebumps.
And that is it's like less doing and more being. And that's a gift the horses can offer to us if we are willing to be in a state of acceptance of that.
Yeah, that's really nice. That is perfect final words. We will continue chatting another time.
Yes, we will.
But for today, we will end exactly here. Thank you, Katrin, for today. I'm really looking forward to listening to your talk. It will be super interesting. And now I will go out and connect with my horses.
Yes, I'm looking so much forward to the summit too. And I hope to see you there.
See you there at the latest. Have a nice day. Bye.
Bye.